Penguin Random House Audio presents A Minor Revolution, How Prioritizing Kids Benefits Us All. This is the author, Adam Benferrato. For All Children. Introduction. When your children are swinging in the hammock, playing in the park, or hunting eggs down by Grandpa's barn, stop and give a thought to the pale-faced factory boys and girls of the metropolis. On a summer evening in 1906, readers of the Spokane Press received the charge on their porch steps. The story, bottom center, appeared on page 4, the back page of the penny broadsheets. Give a thought to the boy with twitching, nervous hands, rolling cigarettes all day long. 5 inches short for the bench, his emaciated legs do not touch the floor. They dangle like hung candlesticks, disturbed into motion by some erratic, soundless metronome. His body smells of his work, an acorned musk in his flesh and clothes. His widowed mother, with 5 younger mouths to feed, had no choice but to swear falsely to the age of her eldest. For this boy, there are no July vacations to dream of. There are no hammocks. There is no play. Sunday is but a day for sleep after the long, hard week. Stop and give a thought to the girl with weak red eyes, an apparition of the candy factory. Her eyes cast an added pallor to her unhealthy skin. She arrives in the dark, she departs in the dark, blinking out of the gates in a perpetual moonlight. You could look through her, but she can be touched. There are scars to be found. Her hands are thin and bony, with here and there a big, ugly water blister where the hot chocolate has spattered. All day, she stands before a long, wooden table dipping creams into hot chocolate coating. But she does not eat them. Long ago, her stomach revolted at the constant sweet smell. Candy to her is just bitter, miserable toil. At the turn of the 20th century, people in Spokane and around the country did stop to ponder the hundreds of thousands toiling on for their pittance in sweatshops, canning factories, and foundries. They considered the street children, the starved and battered waifs, the poisoned infants, the illiterate girls, the doomed boys destined for arrest and prosecution. They stopped to feel outrage. They stopped to despair. Their gaze was directed to the plight of children near and far. Sitting in the heat of a June dusk, looking out on barley fields, a Spokane farmer read on page 3 about 5 English children trailing their mother in an indifferent London downpour. It was their scrape in this life to scrounge 24 cents each day to rent a room for the night. Chairs weren't included, so the family shared their supper, if they had it, condensed milk mixed with oatmeal, potatoes, sat upon soap boxes. The outside light was weak when it arrived, passed through brown paper window panes, and smoke from a foul chimney. If they came up short, the rent collector tossed the family out, and they went to a shelter, either the 2-penny coffin or the penny sit-up. For the 2-penny coffin, each child lay down in a numbered casket on the floor and was covered with a piece of oilcloth for the night. It stuck to your skin unless you put newspaper over your face. As the mother explained, she'd had 6 children, but the baby had died when she was in the workhouse. They keep the little ones separate there and tell the mothers it's a better system. The day her daughter was dying, they let her see her child, but they didn't let her nurse. That left the ashes of doubt. My husband says I couldn't have saved her, but it has always been in my mind that perhaps I might. The people of Spokane did not simply think of Mrs. John Matthews's dead child and what might have been. They stopped to consider what should be. Above the fold on page 4 of the newspaper was a report out of Louisville, Kentucky, on the annual convention of the National Children's Home Society, attended by more than 100 men of national prominence in the field of child saving and general social problem work. Their aim was to promote children's welfare by ensuring that orphan children languishing in almshouses and orphanages were moved into family homes. And every week, the Spokane Press printed announcements of women's clubs, charitable associations, religious brotherhoods, academic conferences and conventions, keynoted by university presidents, all working to better the lives of children. There was nothing special about this Tuesday's edition or the paper in general. It carried the routine reports of an exceptional juncture, a zero hour. In 1906, there was a broad movement underway that championed and prioritized the rights of children. An urgent quaking felt by picking up any newspaper on any day in any town in America. The child savers, as reformers were sometimes known, had emerged in the late 19th century and by the early 20th were forging ahead on numerous fronts. They gave us child labor laws and playgrounds. They helped marshal resources to protect children from abuse and neglect by their parents, and pushed for basic health measures like ensuring clean cow's milk. As supper beckoned, the Spokane reader might have wondered on the safety of the ground beef that awaited his children that evening. Page 1 noted that a state law introducing meat inspections had passed but not yet gone into effect. Tonight's hamburgers were still bacterial trust exercises. But progress was in process. By the end of 1906, Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup, advertised at the foot of page 4 as a miracle cure used by millions of mothers for their children while teething for over 50 years, would be forced to disclose that its primary ingredients were morphine and alcohol. Mrs. Winslow's had long been a dark magic, so effective in calming cries, but always threatening a sleep too deep. For thousands of kids, the creeping shroud could not be lifted. Each breath slower, the limbs growing cold and waxy, the pupils vanishing to pinpricks until the ember was snuffed altogether. Regulation came because journalists, doctors, and coroners investigated, organized, and demanded changes to protect children from such fraudulent and dangerous nostrums. Baby killers, as the Journal of the American Medical Association warned in no uncertain terms. They pressed on until Mrs. Winslow's removed morphine from its formula and soothing from its name. Reformers were following a similar course in reorienting the criminal justice system, and their initial rewards were already evident around Spokane. On page 1 of the newspaper was a story about 14-year-old Frank Hodgden. The previous night, around 11 o'clock, Patrolman Willis had caught him and his friends, Max Berry and George Skine, both 15, stealing flowers from the lawns of the neighboring houses on Frank's street. The young teens had admitted to it straight away, and just a year earlier, armed with the confessions, prosecutors would have proceeded to trial in adult court. As a Spokane prosecutor bemoaned in 1904, "Without any exception, the most disagreeable duty of this office is the prosecution of young boys on petty offenses." But in 1905, the state legislature had created a separate Spokane juvenile court. They'd remodeled rooms in the basement of the county courthouse, and Judge Kennan had given up his divorce and insanity cases to hear juvenile matters on Fridays. In his words, it was a court for correction, not for punishment. The transformation had materialized from the relentless agitation, to quote the Spokane Press, of activists in Washington and around the country who organized meetings and circulated petitions to demand a new approach to child offenders. The legal system should be rebuilt around reformation and character building, keeping children separate from adults and showing them care and respect. Newspapers amplified the message. The Seattle Star.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?